Welcome to Dumb Question. I'm your host, Kent McKay, and I know a lot of interesting people. I bring them on, and I ask them dumb questions. In this episode, Bill Gibson. We talk about clinical genetics, and we speculate about life on other planets. Here is episode 2 of Dumb Question. Welcome to episode 2 of Dumb Question. I am sitting here with Dr. Bill Gibson, and you're the science fiction author, right?
No, Kent. No, I'm sorry. I'm not actually... Did you think you had that person?
Yeah, I got to go through my notes now. I got to change everything I wrote.
Oh, sorry, man.
All right. Well, so tell me, what do you do then? If you're not the great science fiction author, Bill Gibson.
Well, I do actual science. Like experiments and stuff
for real science, not to pretend science.
For real science. All right. In fact, I'm a clinician scientist, so I see patients at BC Children's Hospital, patients with rare genetic disorders, and then we try to solve those disorders in my research lab.
Neat. That I think answers questions 1 and 2. I was going to have you describe what you do in the most technical way, and then explain it to me like I'm 5.
Oh, well, in the most technical way, we take DNA samples from the peripheral blood and use high-throughput sequencing techniques, including whole exome sequencing, to uncover novel and de novo mutations that explain the rare genetic disorders. Is that technical enough, or should I get more technical?
Can you go more? Okay, let's go one more level technical.
One more level technical. Well, much of the work that we do is done at the BC Genome Sciences Center, the Michael Smith Genome Sciences Center, and the whole exome sequencing techniques are next generation high throughput sequencing we then compare the sequences from the patients to a reference genome that's a composite of a large number of individuals, looking for rare coding mutations in the DNA that are thought to be functional and in many cases will cause disease. These are called pathogenic single nucleotide variants, and occasionally different types of DNA variants called indels. That's the main thing of what we do.
Neat. I think I understood next generation in that. That was good. Now, give me all that again like I'm a 5-year-old.
We try to help people who are born with a change in their DNA that makes them sick. We try to figure out what that change is and try to figure out how to make them better.
Perfect. Because I think my audience will fall somewhere between those two extremes.
Sure.
Well, that's great. So what's your current research project that you're working on right now?
So we have a couple of research projects on the go right now. We are looking for rare genetic variants that impact on human body weight, so that would be truly genetic causes of overeating and obesity. We are also looking at syndromes that cause a generalized overgrowth of the body, so that make people unusually tall with unusually large heads, and occasionally also make them obese. One of our recent successes was identification of the gene for a disease called Weaver syndrome. And we found out through studying 3 different families affected by Weaver syndrome that the gene was a known cancer gene called EZH2, or for your American listeners, EZH2.
So what are some of the symptoms of this Weaver?
Weaver syndrome is a genetic disorder that causes intellectual disability. And there are also specific features to the face, a relatively prominent chin with a crease under it, as well as a large head circumference. So these individuals have very big heads. They tend to be quite tall. And for reasons we don't fully understand, their bones mature faster than their, what we call their chronological age. So someone with Weaver syndrome who was 7 years old might have, on x-rays, might have bones that looked like they were, you know, from a 9 or 10 year old. The unfortunate thing is there's also a susceptibility to some forms of cancer, which had not previously been explained, but when we found out that it was mutations in the EZH2 gene, that was already a known cancer gene, so we were able to link that specific problem to the gene that we had identified.
Interesting. So are all the growth genes kind of in the similar area, and that's why you're looking at obesity as well as these other syndromes, or are these markers common that you can find between them?
Sometimes there are common markers that we can find between them. I mean, we're still looking to link these networks of genes into discovering exactly what causes growth, and in this case is overgrowth, and then trying to separate out what causes normal growth, you know, growing in height, for example, and then what might cause abnormal growth, particularly in tumors and cancers.
Interesting. So is there any working cures? Like when someone is, like, are we actually restructuring people's DNA? Is that the goal? Or is it to find the problem, say, in utero and that sort of thing?
Well, we're not able to restructure people's DNA just yet. So the first step in treating any kind of disease is figuring out exactly what it is and getting a correct diagnosis. So the gene test that we've developed enables that correct diagnosis for Weaver syndrome. At the moment, there are treatments and occasionally surveillance. In other words, we might follow someone to see if they had developed a tumor or were starting to develop a small tumor and hopefully catch it early. There are not specific treatments that can fix all the issues with Weaver syndrome. But as with many rare diseases, the key is to do more research in how it works.
Because this is all still relatively new science, like the genome mapping and tracking specific cases. This is all last 10, 15 years, is it not?
Well, certainly identifying the genes for rare genetic disorders is something that we've been doing since, you know, for decades. It really started to ramp up in the 80s, though some major discoveries had been made prior to that time. Why we've really entered the accelerated phase of gene identification is the advent of various forms of what we call next generation sequencing technologies allow us to go through all of somebody's genes at one go, rather than picking individual genes and sequencing them and then going back and trying another gene. We can basically get all the genes that we know of at a reasonably affordable cost. The cost has been decreasing for the past several years. And so now it's possible to get the known coding genes for a price of between $2,000 to $4,000, depending on the center that's providing it and how detailed a look you want to go through after you've actually got the data. So in fact, the bottleneck is now looking at the data. It's not generating the sequence itself. That can be done quite quickly.
Interesting, because before, I imagine these sequence machines were rare and expensive and hard to get to and hard to get time on.
They're still expensive. And depending on how many of them you have, it can be difficult to get time on them. But we've been very fortunate in access to DNA sequencing through collaborators at the Michael Smith Genome Sciences Center in Vancouver, yes.
Yes. So is that like the big one in Canada or North America? Like, how does this...
There are three big next generation genome sequencing centers in Canada, located in Vancouver, Montreal, and Toronto. There are other major sequencing centers in other countries throughout the world, and a lot of private companies are now getting into the game as well.
Because they're cloning people, right? Like, that's what we're working towards.
No, there's more speculation than truth to rumors of human cloning. Isn't that right, Duplicate Bill? Yes, that's absolutely right.
Sorry, I only brought in one chair. I hope you can work out some sort of sharing process between the two of you.
Oh, we can swap around. There, that's much better.
All right, so Duplicate Bill. You also write some science fiction stories, although you are different than the famous Bill Gibson. You're a different Bill Gibson who also writes science fiction stories, which makes marketing your work, I'm sure, very difficult.
I really don't make much effort to market it. I don't necessarily want to compete in that space with someone who's much more famous and a better writer than I am. I have written two plays that were produced by the Spectral Theatre Society, and those were science fiction plays, but, well received by the audience that attended them, which was mostly friends and family. But there you go.
Such is theater. So, as the podcast is called Dumb Question, I tend to ask...
These are great mugs, by the way.
These are fantastic. You can't, the on-air listeners will be able to purchase Dumb Question mugs on a store, a site, which I will post shortly. I figured it to compensate for the otherwise unprofessional surroundings, we should at least have quasi-professional talk show mugs. So, dumb...
Sounds great.
So, a dumb DNA question. Given that like the human genome is a more or less fixed length, I know there's people with extra chromosomes, that sort of thing, but in general it's a certain length, and there's a finite, though astronomical, number of combinations, and not every combination, there'd be whole combinations that we know would be unviable. Would there not be like a fixed number of, though astronomical, number of combinations a person could even be? Is that...
I don't know if you can say that the number of combinations is actually fixed. I mean, with approximately 27,000 genes in the genome, each person, of course, has two copies of most of those genes, except for the ones on the X chromosome. So you're talking around 54,000 genes per person, but a very large number of variants within those genes, and also variants in the spaces between genes. There's a recent major international project called the ENCODE Project has released the sequence of areas of the genome that were previously thought to be junk DNA, but that are now known to actually have an important role in controlling different genes. So when you add up all of that variation and effectively multiply it together, it would be very, very difficult to come up with an actual upper limit on the possible variation between humans, particularly when you add in something called structural variants or copy number variants. It's possible for people to have actual whole genes missing or duplicated copies of genes. And although that can be associated with genetic disease, sometimes those extra copies of genes have different effects on how someone might live their life. So variation in how someone metabolizes a medication that they might take, or even in how they might perceive color, because the genes for color vision are duplicated in the genome. All of these things contribute to the vast wealth of human diversity. So I'm not convinced there's actually a finite number of combinations.
The reason I was asking, just as a personal experiment, I was thinking, assuming life on other planets, for example, and they would be based on, say, for, based on, they would have the same physics and chemistry that we would have. So conceivably, they would have the similar DNA, RNA type structures that are found here. What they would, this is the Star Trek questions. Why do all the Star Trek aliens look like humans with funny foreheads?
Okay.
And it's like, well, maybe there's only so many combinations that are produced viable. Like there are so many quadrupeds, and although there are very different, maybe on the surface, genetically they are more similar than dissimilar. And so I was kind of thinking, as I said, a thought experiment going, well, if there's only so many combinations that are viable, even though astronomically large number, perhaps life on other planets may not, in fact, be that different than life here, just due to the chemistry.
Right. Well, if we're going to get into these areas of speculation, I'll preface this by saying that this is completely outside of my area of scientific training.
Fair enough.
Nevertheless, from a science fiction perspective, if we're going to try to bring some real science to the science fiction, what I would say is, first off, we don't actually know until we either make an observation or do the experiment. So if we go to another planet and discover that there is a different chemical molecule that can contain information the way DNA and RNA does, then we would know that other combinations are viable. If we were to go to other planets and find a DNA, RNA, protein-based chemistry for the life there, what I think to be most likely is there would probably be a different genetic code that the actual codons coding for amino acid additions within the proteins might not be exactly the same. We won't know unless there's some specific energy minimum to having the different codons read in a certain way. But so you, it's conceivable you could have a DNA-based chemistry that had a different coding sequence, but that produced proteins that were very similar. Mm. Now, were we to go to other planets, I think we would and find life there, it would probably be pretty radically different than the life that is on Earth now. And simply, if you look back through Earth's history, there have been all kinds of periods where again, life was radically different. You know, classic example being the era of the dinosaurs, where a completely different type of life that we recognize as somewhat similar, but we would say it's very different from ours, was there. The interesting thing is whether the complexity of life would be the same as on Earth, because Earth has gone through periods of explosions and reductions in biodiversity, so we could conceivably find a planet that had an incredibly rich, very diverse ecosystem, or planets with very impoverished ecosystems. We would be arriving at a particular snapshot in time, assuming that various technological hurdles could be overcome.
Yes. Yeah, I was always curious about like just the math of those large numbers of combinations. Because my biology foundation is very limited. I'm a knee bone connected to the leg bone, so hence the series of dumb questions.
Understood.
It's my understanding that plant DNA,
plants have DNA.
Yes. Okay, is actually like much more complicated and more elaborate than mammals, say.
Yes, it is. Now, granted. Some of the theories of why that is have to do with the fact that plants don't move, which actually means that in order for plants to survive, they don't have the option of moving away from a predator or moving away to
finding
a different
niche, or,
right,
yeah,
to a different climate if the climate gets tough. Which means that in their genomes, they rely a lot more on chemical defenses. And modifying their growth and so forth to survive. And then, of course, on developing innovative ways to disseminate their pollen and gametes to colonize new areas. So they have taken a very different evolutionary path than motile organisms have taken.
Hmm. Because I guess I have heard that they're very different, but it's a very good explanation as to why. I never thought about that before. So what got you into research genetics? What was the seed?
Well, I guess the seed was back even in high school. We had an excellent science teacher by the name of Fred Speed. He really explained biology very well. And we had a wonderful section on genetics that talked about the genes for body patterning and from some of the discoveries that have been made in fruit flies, including the antennapedia gene that actually converts what would otherwise be antenna into what look like legs coming out of a fly's head. And that was, although that seems like a really weird, unusual mutant, and I suppose it is, that thing that looks strange to the eye has an underlying biology that is very interesting. Mm. And it at an instance demonstrated how it is possible for entirely new traits to arise in an organism, some of which might be adaptive, and how new species could form in what would otherwise be considered a relatively short period of time. So that got me thinking also about genetic differences between people. And even when I was going through medical school, it was always with a view towards doing some type of genetics, medical mm-hmm. genetics or research genetics. And so as I've come out the other end of residency and PhD training, that still is an interest that really has a hold of me. So that's what I'm pursuing, is the making genetics relevant to human health.
Nice. So it's got excited in high school and we kept going with that. That's good.
Yeah, I mean, just kept that passion alive. So many new interesting discoveries continued to be made that it hasn't been hard to keep the passion alive. Let me tell you that.
Well, that's good. Like, so you are keeping it, keeps you interested in those new findings and new things to dig into.
That's right. So there's lots of interesting insights to human medicine that can be gained from studying other organisms and studying people with traits that are very different than average. So we find out a lot about the average by studying people who have unique traits, or studying the outliers, as it were.
The statistical outliers, you find the odd person out kind of thing.
Yeah, so the people generally don't like to think of themselves as odd.
Statistically, though.
Yes, not, statistical.
It's not a moral judgment. It's not a value judgment.
Understood.
I've always kind of thought that people who do study genetics of people and looking at different syndromes and that type of thing, and there's different markers in the face and whatnot, that when you're walking through a crowd, you probably see that crowd differently than other people. You probably go, oh, they might want to talk to someone about...
Occasionally that does happen, but mostly I'm just impressed with the diversity of humanity and human faces and all the different biological traits. It's just fascinating to me. And then how we can learn about those traits and use that to, like I said, improve human health and you know, enhance life that way.
Because it's my understanding that most variations are neither positive nor negative. They just have some neutral output. The people may have an extra chromosome and they will go their whole life not knowing that, because there's not necessarily an ailment associated with it. Is that a true statement?
It would be rare for someone to have a whole extra chromosome and have no consequences from it. But yes, a lot of variation between individuals is not well understood. Broadly speaking, a lot of geneticists divide it up into common variation and rare variation.
Okay.
Common variation has mostly been studied from the perspective of disease. So can you accumulate a certain number of minor genetic variants of small effect that collectively add up to a predisposition to cancer or an inflammatory disease? That's the way common variation has been viewed through a disease lens.
Okay.
For rare variants, it's now known that a lot of rare variants that we find in people's DNA have appeared relatively recently. They're relatively new mutations, present only in the recent few generations. And so most of those we think do have some negative effect, although it's probably a small one in the case of most rare variants. Now then, if someone is born with what looks like a genetic disease, we then, of course, look at their rare variants really closely. Where I think we still have a lot of room to move and a lot of interesting biology to uncover is in studying the genetic variants that do encode really common traits. So, you know, what is it that controls the color of someone's eyes, or the whether their hair is curly or not? I mean, there's lots of papers out there, but we really haven't worked those things out definitively. And I think that will be quite interesting to really understand why people are different in traits that are not
considered diseases.
Right, not disease traits, but just ordinary human variation. I think we still have a long ways to go there.
That's interesting, because like I remember reading recently, now probably 5 years, they cloned a cat. They cloned some cats. And they had completely different hair colors than the source material. Now, part of that could have been the variation in the clone, but part of that could be, well, that's such a small variation that we see two cats that seem to be different, not species, but breeds, but actually they're much more similar than we actually think.
Well, and a lot of variation is also controlled by something called epigenetic modifications, which is like putting a jacket over the DNA that controls whether the genes are turned on or turned off.
Yes.
and when that occurs. So certainly some variation in hair color in experimental systems has been attributed to epigenetic modifications. The other thing to know about hair color is that it can be strongly influenced by the movement of the melanocytes that occurs during the embryonic period. So a lot of these specific patterns, like a classic example is the calico cat, where you have two different cell lines, and this is controlled by which of the X chromosomes is turned on or off. And if you have different genes on the two different X chromosomes, then some cells will express one and some will express another in a female cat, and then you get a different pattern that would be, I believe, specific to an individual. So were you to clone a calico cat, the actual coat patterns would be different, because they're not they're not under exactly the same genetic control. There's a rule for stochastic variation in there.
Yes. I've learned so much. Because I always kind of pictured DNA kind of like a series of ones and zeros that would define, like, say, a music file. And, you know, you change the pattern a little bit, and you made out a little bit of noise or a little bit of something, but still it's the same song. And if you change it too much more, then it becomes something completely different. But clearly there's multiple layers of encoding and replication going on that my small infantile model is not taking into account.
Certainly the analogy to a musical score is an apt one, and one that's frequently used, where you take a series of what are otherwise simple building blocks, and you can produce a lot of complexity and beauty based on recombining those symbols. So
neat. So is there suspected that there's some lab out there building something unwholesome, a la Island of Dr. Moreau? Are we even close to that? To start splicing, I mean, I know they're splicing in different genes from different species and creating glow. They like making things glow in the dark for whatever reason.
Actually, thinking while making an animal glow in the dark, that's certainly something that has been done since the discovery of green fluorescent protein and various other fluorescent proteins. It's something that it's possible to do. The question that's better to ask is, why is something being done? So I would be hesitant to speculate about whether there are labs out there doing truly nefarious things with genetic engineering. All of the labs that I know of personally are doing it for the best of reasons, to really understand what's going on genetically and uncover fundamental biological insights.
So what advice would you give to, say, maybe somebody, a young Bill in high school somewhere, and he is thinking about maybe getting into the field of genetics? What advice would you give to such a person?
Okay, well, I guess the first advice I would give is make sure you nurture your passion. Don't let roadblocks get in your way. You climb over them, you tunnel through them, you do whatever you need to do, because everyone encounters roadblocks in their career, and if you let them get in your way, they will always be in your way. The second thing I would say to someone who is interested in biology is figure out whether your talents really are experimental, if you really like working with your hands and doing experiments and figuring out things that way, or whether your talents are more in the area of computing. And that's because this new field called bioinformatics has really exploded and really really enabled a lot of very amazing things. So looking at the data that's coming out of experiments and extracting information from that data. So it's not to say that it's impossible to do both, but it's currently the training streams are all relatively separate, in that if you go in through a computing background and then get a PhD in bioinformatics, the bioinformaticians who have done that have done very well and made a lot of contribute to biology.
Because as you're saying, the problem now is not the shortage of the information, it's the processing of it. We have a glut of data to be analyzed.
That's right. Yeah. So, you know, when I was going through high school, we were still working on Commodore 64s. You know, God rest their electronic souls. But now that knowledge of programming and knowledge of designing the algorithms, I think, will be critical to new biological and medical insights. So, working with experimental organisms or doing clinical research is exciting and fascinating. But if someone's talents really are with computing, don't let that turn them off a desire to do biology, because a lot of brilliant biology can be done, as we say, in silico now, instead of in vitro, in vivo, or ex vivo.
It's a lot in Latin you just threw at us.
Well, in silico is
mock Latin, meaning in a computer.
Yes, in a computer within the silicon. In vivo is in living experiments and living organisms. Yes. Ex vivo, outside of a living organism, so removing a tissue sample and looking at it, and then in vitro, from the Latin within glass, is doing experiments in petri dishes, cultured. So that's something else that I would say to an aspiring young scientist is really think about what you observe in the world, because observations are the critical thing for science. You make an observation, you think about possibilities that might have led to it or that might result to it from it, or possibilities that might result from it, and that's what leads to hypotheses that you can test. You then ask a question of the universe and say, well, I wonder whether streaking bacteria this way versus that way is a better way. And then you test it out and you find out which one works better.
Scientific method. Hey, who knew? So I think we're at the end of our hour. And I know you have a flight to catch. And I know how panicky I get on flight days. So I will release you back into the wild, as it were, to go off and enjoy going home. But I want to thank you for coming down to the luscious Dumb Question Studios and having a chat with me.
Thanks very much, Kit. It's been a real pleasure.
Thanks a lot. For more Dumb Question, go to standupcomic.ca.